Sweet in the morning. Oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning.
Sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning.
Hey there. This is Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White, and this is Wake Up Call. And I'd like to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call. And once again, this is Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White. Wake Up Call is the program. Today you won't hear much from me, but we have a few thoughts, ideas, and music we'd like to share with you. So hopefully you'll stay with us throughout the broadcast. I'm sure that at the end you'll be glad you stayed with us. Stay tuned.
Thank you. But lovers and readers of history know that she is a prodigious writer who has penned a considerable amount of history, much of it about what Americans have come to call Indian country. But her newest work is also groundbreaking, for she dares to attack the sacred text of the Holy Constitution and breaks down the forces and sources that has brought its Second Amendment, the Weapons and Firearms Clause, into being. By so doing, she challenges her colleagues in the bright lights of history written before to make points how and why we consider the second so special. She engages in the hidden history that made the second so desirable and so powerful that it had to be hidden. From European landfall to today, she recounts that which is indisputable, that America is a creation of genocide, slavery, and mass death. From the first days of the emergence of Euro-America, Europeans sought to extinguish non-European life. Indians, Africans, others. The gun, far more than the Bible, made this so. Using archival and public sources, he excavated texts and tables to reveal the sources of something I've never heard of before, that is a distinguished mark of America's deep martial roots, gun. As a young woman, Dunbar Ortiz writes, she was a member of a political collective that, during the 60s, armed themselves for self-defense. Soon, it became the central concern of her collective. Ortiz writes, it seems that our group and others, in the years that the Vietnam War was playing out live on our televisions, were in the vanguard of a trend of owning multiple weapons. Army and Navy surplus clothing accompanied this trend, which was soon replaced by sweatshop-produced camouflage garb to meet consumer demand. Something else was also at work. In Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, published by City Lights forthcoming, Ortiz journeys into untrodden ground, identifying that something else and the deep social forces that gave Americans special hunger for Indian lands, what Hitler and company called Lebensraum, living space. That land hunger was accompanied by the intense hatred against Indian people, and further, the monstrous African slave trade, all of which was done to enrich the wallets of white America. Loaded is a work of brilliance, of intense historical engagement, and of revelation of the America and how it came to be. She smashes the idols of mass worship of the gun and our idolatry of it by showing what truly lies beneath. She desacralizes the Second Amendment, casts it from the vault of heaven, and leaves it lying in the muck and mire, the blood, the hatreds that truly formed America. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
It's the Real News Network, and I'm Gregory Wilbert coming to you from Quito, Ecuador. Police and protesters clashed in Honduras on Thursday. The protests are directed against the vote count for Honduras's presidential election, which took place last Sunday. Opposition leaders are saying that the incumbent president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, is committing fraud. When the first results were announced last Monday, The opposition candidate, Salvador Nasralla, who is supported by a left-of-center coalition, led the count by 5 percentage points. Since then, though, the Electoral Council suspiciously interrupted the vote count twice, and when it restarted, President Hernandez had caught up with Nasralla and is now leading with just under 1% of the vote. Joining me from Tegucigalpa, Honduras, to analyze the situation there is Heather Guias. Heather is an editor with the website Upside Down World and a freelance journalist. Thanks for being here today, Heather.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell us about the protests and what is happening on the ground at the moment. Are there any casualties? What's going on in these protests?
The situation is very tense. As you mentioned in your introduction, there were elections here on Sunday, and this is now the fourth day without final results. So tensions have just been rising throughout the week, and these prolonged silences from the Supreme Electoral Tribunal and a sudden change in a trend of results that we had heard from one Supreme Electoral Tribunal magistrate was irreversible has really generated a lot of uncertainty, and people are looking for answers. So earlier this week, there were some demonstrations, both by the National Party and by the Opposition Alliance, celebrating their claims of a victory. The Opposition Alliance celebrations were very joyous, very colorful, very upbeat environments. And the environment we're seeing today, this morning, and this afternoon on the ground is quite different. So protesters have gathered near where the votes are being processed by the Supreme Electoral Tribunal here in the capital city, Tegucigalpa, and the police are being quite aggressive. They've fired tear gas repeatedly to disperse the protesters. At times, especially student demonstrators have thrown rocks at the police. So the situation is just kind of escalating because Juan Orlando is still ahead, and that goes against what was supposedly the irreversible trend of the results towards a victory for Salvador Nasralla. So it's a very tense environment right now.
So Nasralla, the opposition candidate, is saying that fraud is being committed. What kinds of evidence or what kinds of things is he basing his allegation on?
Yes, so yesterday Salvador Nasralla had a press conference in which he presented his tally of results based on scanned copies of the tally sheets, which all political parties have in their possession. So at each of the polling stations, those tally sheets where the ballots are counted are signed and scanned, and each of the political parties has a copy of those tally sheets for the purpose of transparency. So the Opposition Alliance is saying that it has completed its tally based on its vote count based on those tally sheets, and it's not lining up with the results coming out of the Supreme Electoral Tribunal. The National Party is also presenting its own reports of its results based on its tally sheets, and those are coming up with also different results that throughout the week have shown a victory for the incumbent president. So over these last days, initially, as you mentioned, Salvador Nasralla emerged in the initial report of preliminary results with about a 5% lead over Hernandez. And then after a fairly lengthy silence from the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, which generated a lot of suspicion about what was going on and why it was taking so long for results to come out, results on Tuesday started to show that margin of victory diminishing and eventually Juan Orlando Hernandez surpassing in front of Nasralla. So what was happening during that time was that the Supreme Electoral Tribunal was only entering results from areas of the country where Juan Orlando Hernandez was strong and was discarding results or not entering results from areas of the countries where the opposition alliance has strong support, mostly in the northern part of the country. So what we had heard was that as those areas of the country started to be accounted for, that we would see the trend towards Nasralla's victory return. However, we haven't seen that trend return. Now the vote count is sitting around 92%, and we're still seeing that Juan Orlando Hernandez is ahead. So other irregularities that the Opposition Alliance has denounced include the inclusion of tally sheets without signatures. So in order for the tally sheets to be formalized, those working at the polling stations would sign them before they are scanned. And the opposition alliance is saying that as it goes through the tally sheets, which are uploaded to the Supreme Electoral Tribunal website with the results, it's going through and finding cases of tally sheets that have not been signed. Nasrallah also pointed to the fact that more than 5,000 tally sheets were scanned here in Tegucigalpa, where they're arriving to be counted, and not at the polling stations. And those more than 5,000 tally sheets represented more than 1.5 million votes. A chunk of those were from areas of the country where he's strong. So he was saying that that was another kind of irregularity. In addition, while the Supreme Electoral Tribunal has been carrying out this kind of discriminatory processing of votes favoring areas of the country where the National Party is strong, as they come across polling stations in those areas that voted for the opposition alliance, those tally sheets have been sent to special monitoring, so to go through additional scrutineering in this vote counting process. So Nasrallah said yesterday that in light of all of these irregularities, in addition to the fact that the Supreme Electoral Tribunal's system and servers went down for a few hours yesterday, again suspending the results, he said with all of these irregularities, he does not trust the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, which I should mention is headed by an active member of the National Party who formerly served as a member of Congress for the National Party and also was formerly General Secretary of the National Party. He said that this body is cannot be trusted and that he will not recognize the official results coming out of that body. He will only recognize the physical tally sheets, which the opposition alliance has in its possession. And the opposition alliance has said that it's compared its tally sheets with those of the Liberal Party, and those coincide.
So another thing that I noticed today is that, surprisingly, the conservative magazine, The Economist, had an article in which they claim to give, in which they give credence to the fraud claim, saying that they have a tape recording in which voting center workers were being coached on how to commit fraud during the vote counting process. Has this recording made any rounds in Honduras? Has this been mentioned at all?
That article was very interesting, very damning. I haven't seen it making the rounds in Honduras, but some of the things that article talked about are things that Hondurans are speaking about. So, for example, the use of it mentions the use of the small suitcase parties, which are involved in what they call like a trafficking of credentials. So each party gets to send representatives to each polling station, and the smaller parties that don't really have a grassroots voter base will sell their credentials allegedly to other parties, such as the governing National Party, in order to have more of their representatives at each polling station. And that would make it easier to carry out some kind of fraudulent behavior with the votes. So some of the things mentioned in that article are things that Hondurans have also talked about. And I think that the fact that was published ahead of the elections is quite damning. And it also mentions things like if the votes are not going in your favor, then, you know, why do you care that tally sheet would arrive for processing? And so some of those questions are certainly being raised, as we've seen this kind of preferential processing of the votes, excluding areas of the country in the north where the opposition alliance is strong, and instead processing votes from National Party strongholds.
And what are international observers saying about the vote count and the election?
So most international observers have, you know, lamented the fact that the process is going so slowly, and this is a very slow process. Hondurans are saying we've never seen such a long process to get results. 4 days after the election is too much. So international observers are lamenting that fact. But overall, there's a sense from people who are really worried about fraud being carried out that the international observers aren't saying enough. The European Union observation mission did make some interesting observations, pointing to the fact that there are pretty considerable irregularities in this process compared to the 2013 election, when the results of the election were declared much more quickly. In that case, the European Union mission pointed out that in the time that in this election, one official report of results had been given, there had been five reports of results in the 2013 race. And that mission also made another interesting point about the fact that Honduran media have not given balanced coverage, and that the media coverage in mainstream media has disproportionately favored and given more coverage to the National Party candidate, Juan Orlando Hernandez.
And then finally, what is the institutional situation like in Honduras? What I mean is, does the opposition stand a chance in challenging any fraud in the courts?
That's a good question. In the last election in 2013, there were also allegations of fraud, some of the same kinds of fraud that are being alleged right now. And ultimately, they were not able to prove that fraud had been carried out. And so that's part of the reason that Hondurans who are taking to the streets in support of the opposition alliance right now are so fed up, because they're saying they have already robbed us of the election once in 2013 when Xiomara Castro was the candidate for the left-wing Libre Party. We're not going to allow them to do that again. But it's certainly going to be an uphill battle, because we know that impunity is widespread. The National Party has been involved in multiple scandals, including corruption, alleged links to drug trafficking, and there's been complete impunity, and some of the allegations are quite serious. So the courts are not really in the favor of the opposition, so it will be extremely challenging for that fact. But something that Nazarella pointed out yesterday is that this vote count that he's referring to with the opposition alliance tally sheets is already including some alleged fraudulent behaviors that have been carried out, such as at the polling stations with these small suitcase parties and other irregularities in the process, vote buying, etc. So even with those kinds of fraud included, the voters have turned out so overwhelmingly to vote for the opposition alliance that he's still coming out victorious, according to not the official results as we're seeing them right now, but according to the opposition alliance's count of the votes. So that is different from the case in 2013, when a victory for the National Party was declared early on. In this case, we did have a Supreme Electoral Tribunal magistrate saying earlier in the week that the trend towards victory for Nazarella was irreversible. So certainly, I don't doubt that the opposition alliance is putting together its case. But as you mentioned, given the weak institutionality in Honduras, that will certainly be an uphill battle.
Okay, well, we'll continue to keep an eye on what's going on. I was speaking to Heather Gies directly from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Thanks so much, Heather, for joining us today.
Thank you, Greg.
And thank you.
Over his lengthy public career, Ehud Barak has served as Prime Minister of Israel, as its defense minister, foreign minister, and military chief of the general staff. He's a longstanding supporter of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and of the two-state solution. He's in New York tonight to speak to American supporters of those efforts. When I spoke with him earlier this evening, I began by asking how he sizes up relations between the Trump White House and Israel.
I think it's close relationship, but Israel is still waiting for the Trump program or plan for the regional kind of negotiation and for the how to move forward with the Palestinians. Basically, the president made an impact in the Middle East when he basically said, leave aside for the time being nurturing democracy or dealing with human rights. Let's focus on fighting terror and cornering the Iranian hegemonic and nuclear intentions. That was his basic message to the Sunnite moderate countries and to Israel.
Well, let's take some of these issues one by one. I mean, the president, the administration faces a deadline this weekend. in saying whether it does or doesn't want to see the U.S. embassy moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. What do you expect them to do, and what do you think they should do?
Look, this deadline comes every half a year or probably every year. We as Israelis want to see not just the American embassy, but all embassies in our capital in Jerusalem. And we would love to hear the president announce that that's what he's going to do. But for some reason, American presidents in the last 30 years always announced the good relationship with Israel, but never made the step. Let's wait and see.
Well, we are seeing some early reporting on the Associated Press that what this administration may do is simply say they recognize Jerusalem as the capital, but not yet move the embassy.
Yeah, we know that it's the capital of Israel, and it's always good to hear it from other nations, especially from America, which is the leading power on earth. But, you know, it's the real test is ultimately in action, and we wait for the right time, and we hope it will be early that the embassy will move to Jerusalem. I think it's proper.
You mentioned a moment ago relations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. President Trump has said it's a priority of his. He's asked his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to oversee this. Do you see any progress at all? Is it even doable?
I cannot know. There is a lot of work done underneath the surface. Jason Greenblatt visited the area many times. Jared Kushner visited our neighbors. And every Israeli and Palestinian and every neighboring leader had been addressed. The question is at what stage they will provide a plan which has a chance to win the support, or at least to be a starting point for negotiation by both sides. That's still a question. As I understand, for anyone who talked to the Americans, they are serious about proposing such a plan, but let's wait and see.
Another issue, of course, is the Iran nuclear deal. This has been an ongoing issue for this administration. You have urged President Trump not to decertify this deal, and yet you yourself have long been a harsh critic of Iran. How do you explain that? Why should he not decertify?
You know, I was very hawkish about Iran at the time, probably more hawkish than Bibi or anyone else in our government. It's a bad deal, no doubt about it. But once the deal had been signed, it's a done deal. Even if America decertifies it or pulls out for it, the rest of the signatories are there. Iran might enjoy both benefits and both the legitimization to break out when they decide to, based on the fact that America pulled out of it. So I don't think that it's helpful technically. I think that the Iranians are bad guys and their plans are very bad, and a way should be found to tackle the Iranian challenge. But that's probably not the way, especially now when there is a need, I believe, to drag North Korea into a certain kind of compliance, probably backed right by China, Russia, and the United States. So it will be quite questionable once America pulled out or questioned the Iran deal, how can you convince the North Koreans to enter a new one?
Syria. General Barak, now that the war there is winding down with President Assad still very much in power, influential roles being played by Russia and by Iran, how threatened should Israel be by a post-war Syria?
We are worried by the Iranian possible deployment very close to our border in the Golan Heights and by their effort to establish a plant to produce highly accurate missiles for Hezbollah in Syria. We will do whatever it takes to stop them from developing kind of advanced weaponry plants in Syria for the Hezbollah, or move advanced technologies into the hands of Hezbollah, as well as we keep the right to respond whenever anything happens on the Golan Heights initiated by the Iranians. We hope that the Russians, being basically a stabilizing power now in Syria and in the region, to take responsibility and to make sure that won't happen. But only time will tell.
But just very quickly, Israel is more threatened by this Syria today than it was by Syria before the war?
I don't think so. I think before the war, the combination of the Syrian army, the some probably about 10 heavy divisions, thousands of artillery pieces, many thousands of tanks, probably thousands of advanced jets, and especially earlier, some 15 years ago, with Iraq, with some 30 or 40 divisions, this was a real threat. Nowadays, we are facing a different threat. It's mainly the missiles and rockets of the Hezbollah, probably in the future missiles and rockets from Syria as well, and the activity along the border, which is kind of a low-level terror, but something that can deteriorate very easily, as we saw in the past. So it's a different threat. We will never can underestimate any threat. We cannot afford to ignore any one of them. But in terms of military threat, the heavy divisions were probably a heavier threat.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
So recently, Roy Moore has given a speech at Magnolia Springs Baptist Church in Alabama, and he's got to figure it out what the real problem is here. It's not that he tried to sexually assault a 14-year-old when he was 32. No, that's not the problem. It's not that he tried to rape a 16-year-old when he was in his 30s in the back of a parking lot. No, that's not the problem. It turns out the problem is lesbians and gays. Let's hear it from the horse's mouth.
And I'm still leaving. And they tried unsuccessfully. When I say they, who are they? They're liberals. Right. Mm-hmm. They don't want conservative values. That's right. They're the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. Yes. They want to change our culture. They're socialists who want to change our way of life.
That's right. That's
putting man above God. Yes. And the government is our God. Yes. They're the Washington establishment. It simply wants to keep their jobs, do the same thing, keep everything same, so they don't lose their position, their power, and their prestige.
Oh yeah, of course. They're out to get him. That's the real issue. He mentions liberals and socialists in there. I didn't know there were a lot of socialists down in Gadsden, Alabama, because that's where all the stories are coming from. The stories of the young woman who he assaulted and molested. The stories of how he was banned from the Gadsden Mall in Alabama because he was a pervert chasing after young girls when he was in his 30s. And the stories of how he's banned from football games and the cops had to watch out to make sure that he didn't go after the cheerleaders in the high school football games. Those came out of Gadsden, Alabama. I didn't know that Gadsden was filled with socialists. But let's put that aside for a second. The gays and the lesbians? I did not know that Gadsden, Alabama was a hub for lesbian activity. They have no morals whatsoever. Whenever they're caught doing something, so it wasn't me. It wasn't me. It was the gays and the lesbians. But wait a minute. What did a member of the LGBT community have anything to do with when you cornered a 16-year-old girl in a parking lot and ripped her clothes off? And then you threw her body out of your car in the cold of night. There was no gay or lesbian person in that car. You were in that car. But the thing is, they don't believe in personal responsibility. And so whenever they get into trouble, it was him. Scapegoat. Is it a Muslim? Muslim doesn't make sense. I don't know, let's blame it on the gays and lesbians. Or maybe it was a Mexican, but it wasn't me. No, it was you, Roy Moore. Okay, so now that part is loathsome. And you know, the thing that drives me crazy is the guy was leading the polls before we found out he was a child molester. Now it's kind of 50-50. Okay, so good folks down in Alabama with the Republicans, lots of family values there. But even before we found out he was a child molester, he said Muslims shouldn't be allowed to serve in Congress, so he doesn't understand the US Constitution. It told you a story about how in 2011 he says women shouldn't be in office or in government. And Alabama Republicans are like, yeah, that still sounds right. Everything is the fault of the gays and the lesbians, and they shouldn't have the same rights as us. Yeah, sounds about right. He had said that the transgenders don't have rights, that they don't have any rights, that American citizens, because of their gender identity should not have any rights at all. This guy was a monster from day one, even before we found out he was a child molester. All right, so and he confirms it here, and these are not old stories. This just happened. All right, so that's the substantive part, and then it took a weird turn. That was not the weird part. The weird part's about to come. There's two different protesters that then spring up in this church. One is a legit guy who is bothered by Roy Moore's assertions. He stands up in the church and says some powerful stuff, and of course he's immediately escorted out. Second guy is from the Jimmy Kimmel show, and he's pretending to be a Roy Moore supporter. That's where it gets a little fun, to be honest. Let's watch.
Never once has anyone stated anything like it's occurred in the last 3.5 weeks.
The entire time, all over the line, five statewide
campaigns.
Why would they lie?
And three countywide campaigns. We can stop it and get them out.
Hey, come on, get out of here, dude. We're here for the judge. She's a man's man. The judge is a man's man. You got this, judge. Don't listen to him. Get out of here. That's a man's man. Is that like the face of a molester? That's a man's man.
So the actual protester was saying, stood up and said, "What, you think all the girls are lying? Why are everybody in the town of Gadsden, Alabama lying except you? That doesn't make any sense." Then the Kimmel guy gets up and he goes by Jake Bird. Well, that's not his real name, as you saw, it's Tony Barbieri. Man's man. But my favorite part is he keeps calling him judge. And he keeps saying, "Does that look like the face of a molester?" It's a great twist. He's going to do it again. Watch.
Transgender troops he favors, and he opposes Trump's ban on transgender troops.
You're kicking out your number one fan, Judge. Your number one fan. You know what? Because I believe in the judge, and I don't believe in the ladies who are lying. Does that look like the face of someone who hits on teenage girls? No. That's a man's man.
Pastor Ganella said,
"Thank you."
Pastor Ganella said,
"We
got to hold it down, pro or con. Let's do that."
Okay, that was fun. He has the shirt on, "Gimme More." And part of the point of this gag is that when he was in the parking lot and the reporters were there, a bunch of the Roy Moore supporters came up to him. They're like, "Oh, where'd you get that shirt? I want that shirt." So then Roy Moore finds out that he was actually with Jimmy Kimmel, gets upset and sends this tweet where he says, "Jimmy Kimmel, if you want to mock our Christian values, come down here to Alabama and do it man to man." What's that mean? What, are you going to get into a physical fight with him? What a clown. "Oh yeah, I'll punch you." What are you, a child? Okay, on the other hand, a Republican congressman in Montana slammed a reporter to the ground. You never know. They believe in physical violence, so it's possible. And second of all, what do you mean Christian values? He's not mocking you for your Christian values. He's mocking you for molesting 14-year-old girls. Is that your Christian values? So Kimmel then tweets back at him and says, "Sounds great, Roy. Let me know when you get some Christian values, and I'll be right there." And then one more from Roy Moore. He says, "Despite DC and Hollywood elites' bigotry towards Southerners, Jimmy will save you a seat on the front pew." Yeah, he's not mocking Southerners, he's mocking you. And if you think that Jimmy Kimmel saying, "Hey, you shouldn't have try to have sex with 14-year-olds or rape 16-year-olds applies to all Southerners, there's some chance that you are the one disrespecting Southerners. Nobody is accusing everybody else of doing that. They're only accusing you of doing it. This guy would have been atrocious and terrible and un-American even without any of the sexual allegations. Doesn't believe that transgender people should have the same rights as you. Doesn't believe lesbians and gays should have the same rights as you. In fact, he blames them for his own problems. doesn't believe women should have the same rights, and of course he doesn't believe Muslims should have the same rights. And no one's even asked him about Mexicans and blacks. God knows what he thinks about that. This guy is despicable through and through.
Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the power of mass propaganda with Stuart Ewan.
People are emotional. People are rational. Those are not separate parts of who we are. They are who we are. And our emotions are not our enemies unless they're used against us.
On Contact with Chris Hedges. American culture, or cultures, for we once had distinct ethnic and regional cultures, was systematically destroyed in the 20th century by corporations. These corporations used mass communication as well as an understanding of the human subconscious to turn consumption into an inner compulsion. Old values of thrift, regional identity that had its own iconography, aesthetic, expressions, and history, diverse immigrant traditions, self-sufficiency, a press that was decentralized to provide citizens with a voice in their communities, were all destroyed to create mass corporate culture. New desires and habits were implanted by corporate advertisers to replace the old. Individual frustrations and discontents could be solved, corporate culture assured us, through the wonders of consumerism and cultural homogenization. American culture or cultures was replaced with junk culture and junk politics. And now, standing on the ash heap, we survey the ruins. The very slogans of advertising and mass culture have become the idiom of common expression and political discourse, robbing us of the language to make sense of the destruction. RT correspondent Anya Parampel looks at the power of the public relations industry.
Few industries influence the way you think, feel, and live, quite like marketing and advertising. Pay attention, because according to the New York Times, market research firm Yankelovich estimates that while in 1977, the average person in a city saw 2,000 ads a day, 30 years later, that number was a whopping 5,000. The American Association of Advertisers, today known as the National Association of Advertisers, was established in 1899. Describing itself as the voice of the marketer on its website today, the association boasts a national ad community consisting of 50,000 employees and 1,000 companies representing 15,000 brands, spending $400 billion in marketing and media annually. As technology has evolved over time, so has advertising. In 1922, AT&T revolutionized the industry by selling 10 minutes of radio time for $100 a pop, and the radio commercial was born. The following year, a radio show known as the Ever Ready Hour launched as the first commercially sponsored variety program in history. It was owned by the National Carbon Company. Americans had more disposable income, and consumer culture emerged. Life magazine, as we know it, was first published in 1936 and would eventually be the first magazine to make over $100 million annually in advertising. But nothing would change advertising quite like television. And by 1954, television production company CBS would be the largest ad medium in the world, at least until the internet came along. While digital and TV spending continues to grow, in 2016, for the first time, marketers spent more money advertising online than on TV, with digital advertising only expected to grow. The internet presents marketers with the unique ability to target consumers by race, class, and gender. How influential are these hidden persuaders? Is the result social division, or are we really as immune to advertisers as we'd like to think?
Thank you, Anya. I'm joined today by Stuart Ewan, one of the foremost scholars on consumerism, aesthetics, and mass media. He is professor and chair of the Department of Film and Media at Hunter College. He is the author of All Consuming Images, The Politics of Style in Contemporary Culture, Channels of Desire, PR, A Social History of Spin, and his classic Captains of Consciousness, Advertising, and the Social Roots of the Consumer Culture. Let's begin with your classic, Captains of Consciousness, because you wrote about the advertising industry, but with this book and with all of your books, you understood that this had detrimental effects on democracy itself. Explain why.
Well, to some extent, this was a period of time where The book mainly focuses on the development of advertising in the 1920s. And this was a period of time that was preceded by a great deal of political activism and grassroots democratic activity, including a very militant labor movement. So to a certain extent, the emergence of advertising, in addition to dealing with selling products to consumers, also was interested in selling a way of that Americans should understand themselves, not as citizens, but primarily as consumers.
Well, what's interesting is that this, the engine of this advertising industry came out of the government's, Wilson administration's effort to sell the war and to demonize the left that opposed the war.
Yeah. To demonize anyone who opposed the war. And to make it dangerous to be in opposition to the war. But yes, during the First World War, which was extremely unpopular among Americans, and in fact, Wilson, when he ran for president in 1916, ran under the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And there was massive opposition to the war from various sectors, and a lot of working class movements saw this as a war for capital, a war that was basically looking after financial and business interests. People on the West Coast couldn't understand what this war in Europe had to do with them. Plus, you had a lot of German Americans who had mixed feelings about it. And there was, in fact, prior to U.S. entry into the war, a move on Wilson, which basically said, if we're going to fight this war, we need to figure out how to transform it into something that speaks on behalf of the American people. And so under the slogan, let's make the world safe for democracy, the Committee on Public Information was created. It was the first major propaganda bureau created using modern media by any society. And of course, what happens at the end of the war is that the CPI, this propaganda bureau, is shut down. But you have all of these people who are trained in manipulating mass consciousness, who enter into a civilian sort of battery of consciousness industries, all of which understand that it is important to reach out to people, not in terms of rational arguments, but in terms of, you know, hitting them in the spinal cord, basically.
Well, they understood, or they utilized the understanding of mass psychology, crowd psychology, pioneered by Le Bon, Trotter, and of course Freud. And you get public opinion, Walter Lippmann's Public Opinion after the war. You get Edward Bernays' book Propaganda, and it was that. The grasping that people are not moved by fact or reason, but by the manipulation of emotion. And so, as you write, after the war, these people go from the, you know, straight from the, and this was, you know, they had their own film division, they had their own news division, it was thousands of employees, speakers, three-minute men, you know, going on. And they move to upend, as you write, the traditional values of American society, to instill, in your words, consumption as an inner compulsion.
Yes, and the process of moving from the traditional values, and by the way, traditional values of America are mixed. I mean, there's white supremacy.
They include genocide and slavery.
White supremacy is one of the core values of American society, stuff we're still wrestling with here in the 21st century. But one of the things that's interesting is that prior to the 1920s, particularly among working class folks, there was a sense of collective identity. Mm. There was a sense that their conditions were not a personal problem, but their conditions were defined by the social conditions within they worked, within which they worked, within which they lived. Part of what consumerism does is to take the idea of human aspiration and connect it to a kind of acquisitive individualism. The idea that you as an individual are weak, vulnerable, fearful, and that products are being sold now, not in terms of what the products actually will do functionally, but the products are being sold as in a kind of an emollient that will deal with your personal problems.
Well, you write, in order to get people to consume and, more importantly, to keep them consuming, it was more effective to endow them with a critical self-consciousness in tune with the solutions of the marketplace rather than to fragmentarily argue for products on their own.
Right. This was a period of time where there had been massive criticism of the egregious practices of business. And part of what advertising in its early years was intended to do, and this is what ad people spoke about in their trade journals, was to take that critical consciousness and move it away from focusing on social problems and move it in the direction of people seeing them as personal failures.
Well, and what it, now, so, I mean, and now we end up with Donald Trump, who's kind of the embodiment of this consumer culture, it's and all of the negative values of it. What did that advertising industry do? How did it erode democratic participation and democracy
itself?
Well,
I mean, the minute you start defining human identity away from the idea of engagement and citizenship and more in terms of consumption, then everything becomes a product to be sold. Initially, it's soap and it's bathroom scales and its automobiles and its all kinds of other stuff. But certainly by the 1950s, and certainly with the rise of Nixonianism, politicians and politics is becoming a product to be sold. And so in many ways, what Trump represents is a product that speaks to what is missing from people's lives. And although I'm not sure he has a clear theoretical understanding of the role he is playing, he's somebody who is evoking people, the pictures that people carry around in their head.
He embodies the cult of the self that is at the core of consumerism. It's no longer in that biblical sense about our neighbor. It's all about me. I mean, and this is just infected the belief system.
One of the things that Freud wrote about in the 1920s was the extent to which political leadership is sort of like romantic love. And that is that in the kind of throes of romance, whether it's the love of a love object or the love of a leader, that leader becomes the embodiment. You project onto that leader things you see missing from yourself.
And we're going to come back to that. When we come back, we'll hear more from Professor Stuart Ewan. On Contact with Chris Hedges. Welcome back to On Contact. Let's get back to our conversation with one of the foremost scholars on consumerism and mass media, Stuart Ewan. So we were talking about Freud and the projection upon the leader, which I think very much embodies the kind of support that Trump has.
Well, I mean, the thing about Trump is that he is the embodiment of every man dressed in the sort of aura of success. So the lies that people tell themselves become ratified by who he is. The fact that he's willing to sort of call out people who are concerned about issues like racism and economic inequality, and you know, define them as evil, define them as enemies worthy of scorn, is part. It reinforces people, things that people have wanted to say, but stuff that was also sort of submerged in the period of time from the late 50s through the 60s and 70s, when somehow or another the inequalities of our society became things to be addressed. And so that sense of anger and that sense of hatred that he embodies and so willfully embodies is something that offers people permission to be who they want to be, but felt that they couldn't be until he came there to sort of become a role model for them.
But at the same time, he made his name, in essence, as a reality television star. He's a fictitious. His public persona is fictitious.
Not only his public persona, his business is fictitious.
His business, yes. That's right.
I mean, this is not a guy who actually builds things.
But doesn't that get to the heart of what you write about?
Yes, because in certain ways, what advertising does is it encourages people to see themselves not as actors within the world, not as agents, as having agency within the world, but rather as commodity selves, things to be sold.
And it's all about image. It's not about substance or reality. It's whatever image you can present.
And to some extent, people have that idea reinforced. I mean, I talk to my students about how they prepare for a job interview, and they immediately talk about branding themselves. They
right.
immediately talk about how to dress or how to kind of cultivate the presentation of self as a brand. And so this we live in an economy right now and a society right now where the transformation of the self into a commodity self, into something to be bought and sold, is something that's reinforced by the very nature of the society. And it's people like Trump who take that sort of self-imagination and turn it into a presidency.
You write, or you quote, Kafka's depiction of the modern world as one in which the irrational had become rational. We're also witnessing this fusion of fantasy, facts, lies. There's no longer any way within public discourse to build an argument based on verifiable facts.
Well, I'm not sure that's right. I hope that's not right. But I think one of the things that we need to remember is, and if you go back again to the people who are the founders of the persuasion professions, of the consciousness industries, one of the things that they say, Walter Lippmann says this in his book on public opinion, is that if you speak to people rationally, then they'll just want to discuss things. And that will get in the way of the executive being able to act. And therefore, it's not that people are incapable of reason and are incapable of understanding their own power, but rather that the systems of communication that have been developing over the past 100 years are designed to bypass people's ability to think critically about their world.
And you have a very interesting response to that. And that is that world that remains rooted in verifiable fact is at a severe disadvantage by not harnessing emotion, by clinging to impartiality, objectivity, neutrality, all of which are false.
I think this is key, because I think part of what happens in the early 20th century, by the 1920s, where the persuasion industries are beginning to, and the compliance industries are beginning to bifurcate reason from emotion, that part of what happens is that people who oppose this development embrace an idea of reason which completely rejects the idea of emotion. I mean, you gotta read the Declaration of Independence. You know, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for people to overthrow their rulers, we need to make a case before a candid world. We hold these truths to be self-evident. I mean, Thomas Jefferson was not worried about sticking simply to reason. He understood that part of the power of language is that rhetoric, it doesn't separate emotion from reason. Rhetoric is about persuasion.
Which goes back to the Greeks who understood
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And it's one of the, I think, Achilles' heels of so-called progressive movements, which forswear the idea of making any kind of an emotional appeal. People are emotional. People are rational. Those are not separate parts of who we are. They are who we are. And our emotions are not our enemies they're used against us.
Well, and the forces that are using them against us quite effectively tug on all of those, on family, on love, on whether you're selling cars or anything else, on caring, on community, on the very elements that they're destroying. And those forces within the society that care about community and you know, dignity and justice, I think, as you write, retreat into policy papers and news articles and almost slay themselves.
Well, I think that there is a tendency to view rhetoric as an equivalent, as another word for lying. And I think that's one of the things that we've really lost. There was a time in higher education, particularly when higher education was aimed at elites, at upper-class people primarily, there was a time when it was understood that rhetoric is a fundamental part of education because leadership requires an ability to speak to people as people. And the minute you start turning yourself into a policy wonk, you bypass the ability to speak to people, and in fact, you become somebody who is playing to the idea that reality is a ledger page where you're putting in little factoids that somehow or another will be persuasive. We need to, now, I should say that if you look at the last election, Hillary Clinton embodied, you know, the factoid, not very effectively, and mainly she focused on the factoids about Donald Trump rather than her own supposed policies. But I think, you know, if you look at the last election, I think what's missing from that picture of why it happened that Hillary Clinton is writing about is that there were two people running on appeals to community, family, decency, and so on. And Bernie Sanders was not worried about simply presenting facts. Bernie Sanders was interested in talking to people and to reaching people for who they are. And I think the problem really was that the political establishment made war on that because it went against their...
She's still making war on it.
Well, yeah.
That's why she wrote the book. Let's talk about... Because when you wrote this book, we didn't have handheld devices and YouTube and... In fact, the power of these lies has become more pervasive. The power of manipulation through essentially corporate-driven, corporate-sponsored images is more potent.
It's more pervasive, it's more potent, and I would add that it's more sophisticated. Because in the 1920s, if you look at advertising, they have a very generic idea of who the consumer is. One of the things that happens really beginning in the 60s where there are large numbers of people who are saying, wait a second, your vision of America that's being presented in the ads and in the movies and on television is a completely antiseptic picture and it doesn't include the realities of human life. And so people started articulating the extent to which their lives were being left out of the American dream. And one of the things that happened as people started speaking on behalf of their lives that have been left out of the American dream is that the marketing and compliance industries began to understand, okay, we need to now figure out how to tailor make messages so that they will speak to black folks, Muslims, women, lesbians, gay people, Latinos, Asia. And so what begins to happen is that what comes out of a movement that's designed to create a universalism and inclusiveness is that the marketing machine breaks human beings down into subgroups, into identity politics.
Which makes them more controllable.
It makes them more controllable. It also pits them against each other. And this is one of the tragedies of our time, and that is a period of time where this consolidation of power on a global level at the top, the population at large is fighting over crumbs and is kind of identifying their own particular form of oppression as something that must take priority of all against all of the other oppressions that other people are claiming to experience. It's very dangerous, and with the algorithmic conception of life, where you now have tools which are intimately connected to those devices, which are able to register difference and differentiation, think the very forms of communication fight against the very notion of the common good, of people's ability to see other people in themselves and vice versa.
Great, thanks. That was mass media scholar Stuart Ewan. The public is bombarded with carefully crafted images meant to confuse propaganda with ideology and knowledge with how we feel. The airwaves are awash in lies. Human rights and labor groups, investigative journalists, consumer watchdog organizations, and advocacy agencies have, in the face of this manipulation, inundated the public sphere with reports and facts. But facts alone make little difference. And as we search for alternative ways to communicate in a time of crisis, we must also communicate in new forms. We must appeal to emotion as well as to reason. The photographer Lewis Hine at the turn of the 20th century, Walker Evans during the Great Depression, did the same thing for the working class, along with writers such as John Steinbeck, Upton Sinclair, and James Baldwin. It is a recovery of this style, one that turns the abstraction of fact into human flesh, one that is not afraid of emotion and passion, which alone will permit us to confront the forces of corporate propaganda. Thank you for watching. You can find us on rt.com/oncontact. I'll see you next week.
Be a millionaire or some kind of petty bourgeoisie anytime you live in here. In this country, you gotta be in skullduggery, making you money illicitly to live like somebody. In this country, it's outrageous and insane. Them crazy prices in Port of Spain, and like the merchants going out their brain, and the working like the only toiling in vain. Where you ever hear a television for 7,000, quarter million for Limpisa land? A pair of sneakers, $200, 80,000, 90,000 for motor cars. At last, here in Trinidad, we see capitalism gone mad. It's sad. Cause do capitalism gone mad. To provide for your family today on your present salary is an impossibility. In this country, so many bills to pay, there is no conceivable way to save for a rainy day. In this country, avariciousness, to be precise, is why every damn thing so overpriced. Big business making everybody feel, government give them I open license to steal. Would you believe me? One nylon panty is $19.90. $20 for some baby milk. The cheapest jersey costs over $60. $200 and change a yard for silk. It's hard here in Trinidad. Lord have mercy, capitalism gone mad. It's sad. Things getting more bad. Oh, Lord. God. Capitalism gone mad.
This is Furry Band Five.
To buy a pack of cigarettes, just leave you with a hole in your wallet, and money is so hard to get. In this country, necessity or luxuries, it doesn't matter what the item is, they're charging anything they please. In this country, primary school books, prices loot, is highway robbery, the price of food, all hopes and dreams elude the poor man. But politicians still expect good work attitude. Just imagine this, the cheapest coffee, over 3,000, not even dying today, easy. Thousands of dollars for the undertaker, so you could get a spot in the cemetery. It hard here in Trinidad. Oh Lord, capitalism gone mad. The gladness that once we had is gone because capitalism gone mad. You got to have heavy contact, know how to move up in society to make any kind of impact. In this country, you got to know how to chip the field, how to scheme and swindle properly, perfect the art of wheel and deal. In this country, I say survival in this land isn't easy for no man. With unemployment and high inflation, somehow we go dead before the end of this recession. Where the hell is this Sam Mango Julie? Costing $3.50, $40 for one watermelon. Half your salary for fish, meat and poultry. Time you buy greens, all your money done. It's hard here in Trinidad. Lord have mercy, capitalism gone mad. It's sad and getting more hard. Oh, Lord, capitalism gone mad.
With all that's going on in the news, we can't allow ourselves to forget that this is also the set of just a few weeks that will determine the life or death of net neutrality going forward, because the FCC is looking to destroy it, and that is coming up very soon. With that in mind, I've got bad news for you. And that has to do partially with how people view the topic of net neutrality, but also maybe why they view it that way. And that has to do with the coverage or lack of coverage in the media. And this is mostly coming from the great work of Media Matters in cataloging this. Let's bring up this first graphic. You're going to see the broadcast news networks that NBC didn't talk about at all, not for 1 second. ABC somehow found a way to talk about it for 25 seconds. I don't even know what that would be for 25 seconds.
I do, yeah.
Yeah? And then we get 2 minutes out of them. CBS, right?
Yes.
I don't know the logos. I think it's CBS.
Yeah, it's
but
CBS.
It's not a lot of time. It's really not a lot of time. Now, that's the broadcast networks. Now, thankfully, the cable news networks did talk about it more, although it's not that much better. MSNBC was actually the best. They far outpaced the coverage of net neutrality compared to CNN and Fox News. From originally being reported on the Rachel Maddow show, this most recent push on November 20th, they have since spent nearly 47 minutes on net neutrality, which, when you consider that these networks all have 24 hours and repeat the same stories over and over, it seems low even then. But let's compare that 47 minutes to CNN, which devoted approximately 10 minutes, and Fox News, which spent a little more than 11 minutes. However, that included two interviews with Ajit Pai, who's going to destroy net neutrality, on Fox and Friends. I'm sure it was a substantive deep dive. And Pai gave no other interviews and segments included in the study. And so the raw numbers, maybe 10 minutes and 11 minutes sounds good, but if that is basically purely from the point of view of the person who wants to kill net neutrality, maybe it would be better if they didn't talk about it at all.
Yeah, of course, Fox is on the side of giant media companies who'd like to control the internet and pass their own regulations and not let the government protect our interests and basically protect the internet as it is. That's not surprising. NBC not running any stories on it when they're owned by Comcast, one of the internet service providers, also not surprising. But credit to MSNBC. So they're also owned by Comcast, but they spent the most amount of time on that issue. Yep. So maybe not enough by our standards, but still way better than the rest. So credit to them, especially because they're owned by Comcast.
Yeah, and interesting, I believe that you already reported this, but we should repeat that Comcast recently deleted their three-year-old no paid prioritization net neutrality pledge, where they said that they would not, you know, have tiers, basically, where if you pay more, you get more, or more likely, if you don't pay more, you get less. That's usually how that works out. And oddly enough, it's a weird coincidence, they deleted that pledge on the same day the FCC said they were going to destroy net neutrality. Weird how that works out.
Yeah, and I like how while Obama was in charge and while they were pretending that they were going to be moral actors, they're like, no, we'll protect the internet on our own because we care about the public. Okay, they're like, oh, we don't have to care about the public anymore. Trump's in charge. Yeah, we were just kidding. Obviously, we change our own laws anytime we want. It's just they're not actual laws. And so we changed our rule and we decided that we can slow down your website.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if this gets destroyed and we start to see those tiers of service and the vast majority of us end up on a crappy tier where it's not that they're building new higher speed things for those who pay more. They will find ways to cut your speed now and probably charge you more for it even then. That's going to affect all areas of the internet. Our show, porn and Netflix, which is the vast majority of what most people do. But I automatically think about people who are debating whether they can afford to have the internet in the first place. Maybe they don't have it yet. The US has lower rates than a lot of other parts of the world. Or schools that are considering hooking up more internet capable computers. Like, think about those people and what will end up happening to their experience. Like, if they're trying to use the internet for education, for instance, doing classwork and things of that sort. Like, think about how much we already have this huge inequality in terms of educational outcomes between classes, and that could only get worse. The internet is supposed to be the great equalizer, but it's not going to be equal anymore. So that's going to be great for a lot of Americans.
So before we get to other parts of the story and what Americans think about net neutrality, I just want to give you an avenue to fight back. So one thing you can do is you can sign a petition that, let's go to graphics 16 through 19, Jesus. A petition that the Just Democrats are doing. So these are the guys who are uncorrupted. They don't take corporate PAC money, so they don't represent corporations. They represent you guys. JustDemocrats.com/net neutrality. And the petition says, the FCC under the leadership of Trump appointed Chairman Ajit Pai is set to end net neutrality with a vote on December 14th. This move by the government agency will effectively sell the American people out to large ISP conglomerates like Comcast and Verizon, who will be able to charge websites to reach users at faster speeds. Now, this is interesting. If you guys didn't know, they point out, luckily, Congress has the power to reverse any decision made by the FCC through a congressional resolution of disapproval and can also apply political pressure. Please sign this petition and call your congressperson to demand that they do everything in their power to stop the nonsense of Trump and Pai from destroying the internet, or there will be consequences. Now, by the way, you could, now Ajit Pai is not going to listen, but you could email him, be civil, ajit.pai@fcc.gov. And the vote's on December 14th. This is the building, Federal Communications Commission, 445 12th Street Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20554. Look, let's stop there because, what do we have left? They're inviting disaster, right? So, there's all these comments that were sent to the FCC. John's going to tell you about that in a second and what a joke that turned out to be. Okay, so they don't care. Most people are against it. They don't care.
Democrats and Republicans are against it. Yeah, they don't care.
Yeah, Republicans, voters are against it. They don't care. So what do the Republicans do whenever they're in a bad situation? They get physical. So the most famous instance is, in Florida, they started the recount in 2000, and a bunch of Republican lobbyists and staffers get together, and they went and circled the building in Miami-Dade to stop the recount. And it worked. And it worked. Mm-hmm. They pretended to be real Americans who were outraged that we were counting the vote, as if a thing like that exists, yeah, right? And they shut down the vote. And it turns out if they had recounted all of Florida, Al Gore would have been president. And it worked. So, okay, well, then surround the FCC building on December 14th. Don't let them take the vote. So don't do anything physical to any human being. Please, 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 okay? So, you know, we're on the left. We're not, we don't believe in physical action against human beings, okay? But on the other hand, the FCC building, look, if we had any kind of semblance of democracy here, you know what other countries do? They pour into the streets. There's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. There should be 100,000 people surround the FCC building going, go, yeah, see if you can take the vote now, okay? That's the only thing left.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, realistically, this is, we should have, I don't know if it needs to be a constitutional amendment, but, and maybe this is just gonna make me sound like a geek, but there's a variety of rights that we need to have. One of them is the right to, you know, unrestrained access to the internet. It's not an optional thing. This ain't the early 90s. This isn't just for like people who want to play Doom or something like that. You need this for every area of life, from commerce, business, school, relationships, increasingly everything. And one of the reasons I think that they might be able to squeak it through right now is, one, is we allowed Trump to be elected and we knew that this would happen since he spoke out in 2014 against net neutrality. But also that people have been worn down by multiple times that we've already had this discussion. Under Obama, this came up multiple times and we put pressure on the government and they went in the right direction. Obama and the FCC at that point went in the right direction. And so it just keeps coming up over and over and over. And this time they might actually succeed.
So the petition will have the link down in the description box on YouTube and in a comment section on Facebook. But let me tell you where we are on the polls and what Americans think about this. A poll from Morning, this we're going to graphic 32. It's a poll from Morning Consult and Politico released on Wednesday found that 52% of registered voters support net neutrality regulations compared with 18% who say they don't. Now, the main issue there is that most people don't know what it means.
And 40% don't have an opinion.
Yeah, and so of 46% that they've heard a lot or some about net neutrality recently, that means the majority of Americans have not heard about it. And so partly because of what John pointed out, which is that the media is hardly covering it at all. So since they didn't see it on TV, a lot of older Americans, they never heard about it. So whereas the people who did hear about it, the numbers are overwhelming, 52 to 18 on our side. In fact, 55% of Democrats are for net neutrality, that's keeping the internet as it is, but so are 53% of Republicans.
Yeah.
The Republicans go, wait, no, don't take away my right-wing websites. You think those big cable companies are gonna care about your right-wing blogs? No, you're first on the chopping block. They don't like your bigotry, that it costs them customers.
Yeah.
So that's why actual voters hate this thing. Now, which leads us to the hilarious situation, which is graphic 34, about what happened when they asked for comments of the FCC. But first, let me give you a little bit of context. Last time they did this in 2014, a lot of people sent in comments. They sent in about 450,000 comments overall, and they were almost all for keeping net neutrality. And so the Republicans on the commission looked at that and go, when you ask for comments, it doesn't turn out well for us, right? They like the internet. They want to keep it as it is.
Yeah.
We tried to do our propaganda. We sent Ajit Pai on Fox News and we did all that stuff about, oh no, keeping the internet as it is would be government regulation. Instead, let Verizon and Comcast do any regulation they like, but only for their benefit and not yours. Oh, damn, that didn't work. So this time they asked for comments, but now there are bots. So they get 22 million comments, but let's,
woo,
okay, let's look into that. Pew Research Center found out, and this is reported by The Hill, the organization found that of the 21.7 million comments submitted to the FCC on the Obama era rules this year, just 6% were unique. The other 94% were duplicate comments.
Wow.
Okay, now to give you context, which side has the duplicate comments? Now, one instance was 2.8 million people sent in the same comment because John Oliver did a segment on it.
That's true.
Which is awesome, okay? That's a lot of people, man.
Yeah.
God bless John Oliver.
Considering that he does like 8 minutes of video a year, he devoted a lot of it to net neutrality going back through the year. So he deserves a lot of credit for that.
So those are actual human beings who got worked up by John Oliver, bless his heart, and said, yes, I want to keep net neutrality. Now let's look at the rest. The seven most common messages found in the record comprise 38% of all the comments, just seven, right? Six of those, one was John Oliver's fans. Six of those were anti-net neutrality messages submitted a combined 5.5 million times.
Maybe the people really don't like net neutrality.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they were listening to Rush Limbaugh and he's like, oh, who needs the internet? And 5.5 million people got on and said, oh, no, I'm going to send the same exact message, right?
Yeah.
No, or perhaps those big internet service provider companies were like, oh, there's a thing called the bot where we can pretend the people are on our side. Send the same 5.5 million messages saying, oh, I hate freedom on the internet. Please slow down all my websites. I don't want to watch Netflix. Oh, I want it to be really slow. Porn, yuck. No, slow that down. I don't want that either. Okay.
Bots are people too.
Yeah. Right-wing and left-wing sites that don't agree with the establishment. I hate those. Please let Verizon and Comcast control them.
See, right? Look at this elitist lib over here. I don't know about you, but sometimes when I watch things online, like Westworld, the plot's really complicated. It's hard to follow. It's nice when it pauses all the time for like 10 seconds and buffers. It gives me time to think about the plot, figure out what's going on. I have a couple of other numbers, though. 7.7 million comments were submitted from mail domains attributed to the website fakemailgenerator.com.
Gee, I wonder where they're coming from. Million. I can't quite tell.
Also, and it's interesting to find out, sometimes there's geographic differences in how much people care about an issue. Like some issues, you know, in California they care a lot about some. In Florida they care a lot about it. In this case, it was from somewhere else, though. 445,000 comments came from Russian email addresses.
Huh.
So it turns out they just really care about stopping net neutrality in Russia. It's weird how that works out.
It is kind of weird. It's funny how whatever.
By the way, that's more than all the comments that came around the last time the FCC solicited comments came from Russian email addresses.
Now, do you think the Russians really care about making sure that Verizon and Comcast make more money?
Yes.
No. Okay. But somehow, whatever Trump supports, there's websites in Russia that also support it. Yeah. What a weird coincidence.
Hmm.
And so, look, you guys, for the people who do understand net neutrality and understand that it stands for freedom on the internet and keeping things as they are on the internet, for those folks, when Ajit Pai and those clowns go around saying, oh, we have a lot of comments from fake.com saying that they just think net neutrality is terrible. They just don't want the internet to stay as it is. You think we're not going to catch you? You think we're not savvy enough to figure out where it's coming from?
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, Pew Research Center did a wonderful job.
Yeah.
But you're going to get caught either way. To them, it's just a joke. It's just a way of how do I do propaganda? Enough of a fig leaf for me to do whatever my literal corporate masters told me to do, because Ajit Pai worked for them before. He will work for them again. They're the donors to the Republicans who are supporting this. And when they go out, they'll probably work as lobbyists for these same companies.
Yeah.
So when people talk about revolution, this is it. I mean, you need a revolution so that the corporations don't take over every single part of our lives.
Yeah.
They've already captured the government. Now they're going to capture the internet. And that's and who's the only people fighting back? Look. A lot of folks online, give them credit. And by the way, yes, right-wing and left-wing sites, so bless their hearts. And yes, Google and Facebook are the good guys in this case. And Netflix, they're all fighting for net neutrality. But also on the political side, the just Democrats. Because the corporate Democrats are like, oh, it's bad. Right? But they also take corporate money. Just Democrats don't take corporate money, so they care. JusticeDemocrats.com/net neutrality. The link is in the description box. Sign the petition. Find any way you can to fight back.
This is CPR Radio. That's Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White, and this is Wake Up Call. We've come to the end of our first segment. In our second and final segment, we will hear from Professor Joy DeGruy. I advise you to stay tuned.
Para que leva chuliba lutua, lutua.